Blog Talk Radio. Firefly Willows LIVE presents Revolution, featuring your host, Heisi Lutmers.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Thank you for listening. I am once again this morning joined by my co-host, John Carosella.
Morning.
Deb Carosella.
Good morning.
And Mildred Lynn McDonald.
Hello.
And it seems as if many people I hear from have lots of different changes, transitions, etc., going on in their life. And with that comes having to make different decisions about what to do, what direction to go, what to change, what to let go of, etc. And I came across an article that spoke directly to that, that I thought was very interesting because it was about trying to identify if a person is a maximizer or a satisfier. That's the term they use in the article and in the study that they did. And it really is about examining whether we're only making decisions for the maximum benefit or potential, or if we're making decisions that are ultimately really right for us, even if it doesn't seem like the maximum thing, like choosing the right job or deciding to take the job that we feel is right for us, even though it's not the one that may pay the most. So the first thing that I would like to do is, using some of the questions that they asked in the study, I'm going to ask the co-host as well as anyone listening, I would also like you to think about how you would respond to this. And this is to see if you tend to be more of a maximizer or a satisfier. And so when I ask the question, if the co-hosts would please respond with however they would like to respond. So I'll just ask the co-hosts if you will give your response to each of these things. And if you want to say perhaps why or how you decide that way, that's fine, or if you just want to say yes or no, that's fine too. And anyone listening, think about how you would respond to these as well. There's four of them. So the first one is, I never settle for second best.
Well, never is a long time, but I would say that I try really hard not to settle for second best most of the time.
I actually don't have a problem with I try to be discerning, but I am definitely more in the category of, does this make the most sense? Is this the easiest thing to do? How much work is this going to be? So sometimes second best is the best choice for me.
And I find best really subjective. So I would go with the being satisfied.
So the second one is, when I'm in the car listening to the radio, even if I like the song, I often check other stations to see if something better is playing.
I never, ever, ever do that. Ever.
I used to do that all the time.
I don't do that. I enjoy the song that's playing and anticipate the next one.
So the next question, I'm a big fan of lists that rank things like the best movies, the best graduation speeches, the best looking professors, etc.
I don't usually pay too much attention to lists that rank things, only as a curiosity and well after any point of relevance. I also, like, if I'm going to make a decision about going to see the latest movie that's been released, I typically don't even look and see what critics have said about it, because I don't actually care if it looks like it's something that I have an interest in and would be entertaining to me. I'm going to go watch it.
I will look at best lists when I have some disposable time, like I'm trying to figure out what movie to watch. I'll look at the top 10 lists, see which ones are good.
I look at the list from a perspective of a time saver. So it would be from a data point, having data in all one area rather than the ranking from 1 to 10. And I've looked at them and I thought, oh, this is great. I don't have to do all this research.
Which up to this point, Mildred, you've been a satisfier, whereas that one you answered, that you're a maximizer for that question. If you say that you would check a list because it would save you time and not have to do all of the research, that means you're maximizing your time.
Okay, I'm a maximizer in that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then but if I could add something, the point that a person ranked something number one or ranked it number five or ranked it number 10, that would be irrelevant to me.
Well, right, but you're still utilizing the list to maximize your time and energy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
So then the fourth question, I treat relationships like clothing. I expect to try on a lot before I find the perfect fit.
I don't think that that's me. In work relationships and personal relationships, I tend to take people as they are in that department.
For me, the question almost doesn't even make sense because each individual is an individual, and how I relate to them is how I relate to them. I don't have any agenda as to stacking anybody in a preferential order or putting time and energy into this one, but maybe another one, a better one's going to come along so I can drop that one out of the queue. They just are.
Well, so you can think of this in terms of relationships with people, but also relationships with other things, like, say, relationships with a job. These questions come from a study that was actually done with college seniors who were searching for jobs. But even if you think of, like, a job relationship or your relationship with the work you do, a lot of people will say, you know, well, I'll go work here for a year or two, and then I'll go work here for a year or two, and I'll go work here for a year or two. They try out different jobs, different places to work, to find the right fit rather than seeking out the best place that they may be at for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think that question encompasses more than just our personal relationships with people.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you think of college people, it's kind of like saying, you know, I date a lot of people rather than just I start dating one person and date them for all of the year and then date a different person versus I date a number of people until I find the right one.
I still have a tendency to be a little bit more what could be considered old school in this day and age's mindset. While I don't have an objection to moving on from something if it doesn't feel that it's correct for me, my goal is not to try out a whole bunch of stuff. I don't like change that much. So I would prefer to find something and settle into it and be there rather than have the goal set up for this is only a temporary thing and I'm going to be moving on anyway.
I have to say I look to be harmonious fit. And that could be more than one song could be in harmony with me, my song, my personal song. So that's where I tend to go. How do we sound and feel when we're together? And that would go for a job, that would go for a person, whatever.
So, like I said, these questions came from a study that was done. And those questions in particular, if you answer yes to a majority of them or all of them, then they would classify that person as a maximizer, which is somebody who always looks for the best option. And sometimes that means they're not necessarily looking for what is best for them in terms of overall satisfaction and happiness. But the best option, so again, I'll use the same example, but like the best option could be I'll take the job that pays the most rather than I'll take the job that seems like the best for me. And the other classification is called a satisfier. And that is someone who says, I will, and I know that this, I think this term is a little misleading, but the way they describe it is I will settle for what is right or best for me at this time, rather than necessarily choosing what would be considered the best option. But I don't think settling here is a bad thing. It's more a sense of this is what feels like the right and best thing for me, even though it may not be the highest paying or whatever.
I think for me, I have been historically very much a maximizer, an optimizer. And I'm just now starting to realize that there's a kind of narrow-mindedness in that, because if you prescribe for yourself all of the variables, all of the values to all the variables, and you insist on having those all met, then you don't leave much room for mystery. You don't leave much room for serendipity and the undiscovered, unknown, unknowable value that could be sitting there in a less optimal solution just because you didn't understand that those things existed or that they might potentially be as meaningful to you as they turn out to be. And that was, you know, what I took from that article was the possibility that you could grow into an experience that you initially thought was suboptimal, you know, making the most of something, you know, making the decision the right one because you have embraced it totally. And there are some powerful lessons in that for me.
I think one thing that was really important in what this article also pointed out was when we're faced with different choices and decisions, first of all, the study showed that people that were satisfiers tended to be happier, because people that were maximizers were never quite happy with the decision they made because they always continued to compare themselves to other people. So even if I chose this job, they would start saying, yes, but is it as good as the job that so-and-so has? Or am I making as much as so-and-so? And so they always tended to be less happy because they never stopped the process of, is there some way to maximize this more? Is there something else that I can be going after, that I can have, that I quote unquote need? Whereas satisfiers tended to be more content and happy because they knew they had chosen what felt right for them. And I think where it said, choosing the first acceptable option, that to me is kind of that intuitive process, because it's saying this immediately resonated with me, or my intuition said that's the thing to do. So I'm not going to continue fighting against my intuition or that feeling inside of me, versus I'm going to accept that this is the right thing for me at this moment. Therefore, I'm going to go ahead and take it. But the key to that is also something that is said in this article, which is the quality of the decision you make will be determined not by picking the right one, but by the actions you take post-decision to make the most of it.
Yeah.
So if a satisfier took the first thing that came along, but then used that as an excuse to just stay complacent and to get stuck in a rut and to not go through the process of growing or evolving or changing when those opportunities presented themselves, that becomes a different issue versus that initial decision-making process.
Or you could be putting a structure around yourself that you're striving to achieve based on external validation rather than looking at your internal voice. So buying into you need a big house, lots of money, flashy car, whatever, to be successful, and basing your decision on what do I need to do to achieve that, rather than listening to your inner voice, where your inner voice might be saying, to make me happy and what's in my highest interest is to do something in the realm of apple trees and grapes. Now, I may never look like a success in society, but I'll be very happy. And they're not mutually exclusive. You could also achieve some degree of infamy.
Well, I think that's true. I think a lot of times you hear people say things like, well, I'd love to do what I would really like to do, but I wouldn't make as much money. And so it says, I'm willing to sacrifice my happiness and satisfaction in the work I do just to make more money, as if I couldn't be happy if I had a smaller house or if I had, you know, less than three cars, or if I couldn't spend $3,000 a week on going out to dinner or whatever it, whatever their criteria is. People very often get stuck kind of in that lifestyle and the external things as the measure. But I also find that those people are never satisfied, because they will say things like, well, my goal has always been to live in this particular exclusive neighborhood, because living there to them signifies success or achieving something or, you know, whatever. But invariably, if they achieve that and then they're living in that neighborhood, what do you start to hear from them 6 months or a year later? Well, you know, I've been looking at houses over in this other neighborhood now, and I'm thinking that maybe we'll move in a couple of years. Or, well, this 7-bedroom house is great, but now I'm thinking that maybe we'll get a 10-bedroom house. So it's as if they maximize in the moment, but then that never seems to be enough. So they always are looking how to one-up the maximization, which means they're never happy, they're never satisfied, and they never stop trying for something more, oftentimes based on external definitions of success, et cetera, but also comparison to other people and what they have, the keeping up with the Joneses syndrome, yeah. Versus the satisfier is much more going to say, you know, I really love the job that I do. And I've heard people say, How can you keep doing a job where you only make that much money? And some people can't grasp that, because if you're not trying to constantly climb the ladder and not trying to constantly move up in the sense of to a more expensive car or a more expensive neighborhood or whatever, then somehow you are lacking something.
I agree that that's, it seems to be a very prevalent attitude and way of being, particularly in U.S., you know, society, or maybe just particularly in the area that we happen to live in at the moment. I've never quite understood, because it never really has resonated with me on a personal level. I kind of understand intellectually, but it's not how. I don't find it a satisfying way to live.
Yeah, I think maybe there's two aspects to this question. One is whether you know enough about what makes you happy to choose that versus what society tells you might make you happy. And the other is knowing what makes you happy, realizing that a choice in front of you, an opportunity to choose something that is suboptimal in that department, and choosing to work with that after you've made that choice, or waiting before making that choice and seeking something that you that will in fact meet more of your needs based on how well you understand yourself. And I think it's better to know what makes you happy and choose that than to rely on society's definitions of what makes you happy and kind of continue to seek out those things. But in the latter case, where you actually have a good sense for where your heart wants to be, and you know, as a satisfier, you choose the first acceptable option, even though it's not really the complete package, and you choose to embrace it as an adventure, an engagement with the unknown, which would be the satisfier's approach, versus seeing it as settling on something that's subpar and feeling like this really isn't the thing that I want. In that case, I'm trying to be more accommodating to the mystery. I'm getting better at not insisting that it be exactly as I expect it to be.
I think a satisfier can do that, because it's not about just choosing the first thing that comes along. It's the first acceptable option. And I think that oftentimes the satisfier is happier because they're able to see that option as acceptable because it's one step along the journey,
yeah,
rather than it has to be the destination and I have to wait until I find the end goal, because the end goal or the next thing that is even better for them may not be available yet. And so taking something that is right for right now is what helps to move them towards the next best thing. rather than keep holding out and holding out and missing out on opportunities. Because somebody could say stay on unemployment longer than they need to by not being willing to accept a job in the interim until the right job comes along, rather than suddenly getting into that mentality of, well, I'm not going to do that kind of work. Well, I don't want to work in that kind of company. Well, I don't want to do that kind of a job. And now they've put themselves in a more stressful situation because maybe they keep holding out for the best job and their unemployment is running out or whatever. And that's where I think the difference is the satisfier understands making a decision to accept what is here and available now is what's best for me because it'll help to move me forward rather than I need to wait and wait and wait and wait and wait for the maximum best thing, which may not be ready or available, or I may not be ready for it yet. So my final question for you is, what suggestion or tip you would give for being able to make the most of a decision that we have made after having made the decision, that post-decision maximizing that, making the best of it, versus falling into the trap of thinking, I've made that decision now, I either constantly second guess it, or I don't even enjoy, appreciate, or take advantage of what that decision has to offer me because I'm already focused on the next thing.
I have three tips. And the first one is my favorite. It's to learn to laugh at yourself and say, who cares, so what? And my second tip was, as you were speaking earlier, Heisi, about being satisfied, what kept coming into me is cultivating courage. And the third thing that kept coming into me was trusting yourself. So I guess my fourth tip would be, and this is something that I use myself, is I have made the decision to trust myself that whenever I'm confronted with whatever, that I will know in the moment how to handle it. Not that it's right, not that it's wrong. I trust that I will come to the table with a solution or a perspective that is in integrity with who I am and could be a growth opportunity. I can't tell you how much weight that's taken off my shoulder and how liberating and freeing that has been. So that's what I would put forward for our listeners.
I like something that Mildred said earlier about, I think she was speaking in about the relationships aspect in particular, being in harmony. How does what you have done or what the decision that you have made, how does it feel for you? Find the harmony in that. Find the flow where you now just go with it and you make the best choices within the decision that you've made and you follow it. You see where it takes you. Trust yourself, as Mildred has stated as a tip, and allow yourself to live it.
And I think for me, what's written above the Oracle at Delphi is so important. You know thyself. If you don't know yourself well enough, it's really hard to choose and be satisfied because you don't know what you're choosing. You don't know why you're choosing it. And sometimes I think that is a process that's enhanced by not fighting to get the optimal answer because you discover things when you embrace and accept that which isn't perfect for you.
And I think for me, it's maybe a combination a little bit of what John was saying and something that Mildred was saying is to make it your decision rather than the decision that is based on what other people tell you you should be deciding, what society tells you would be the best thing to do, or that you're not making the decision to somehow try to please or satisfy others at the expense of pleasing or being satisfied for yourself. But also having that trust, the courage just to make a decision, and then the trust that sometimes this decision is simply the best one in the moment. So deciding and staying in the moment, not worrying about 10 steps ahead and not trying to escape from something in the past, but to decide in the moment and accept that that may just be the best thing for now, and it may be what's needed to provide the step from here to the next thing. So So don't get caught up in this decision is life or death. It's the end all be all. And if I decide this, I'm stuck with this forever. Versus, no, you just make this decision, you work with it. You can always make another decision after that. You're not bound by it necessarily. That's what I would suggest to people is decide in the moment, trust your own decision process rather than relying on what other people are influencing you or trying to tell you would be the best decision. And be able to see decisions as the best in this moment, meaning it may just be temporary or a step towards something else rather than always having to try to find that permanent decision to make for the end all be all. So now I'm going to make the decision that we will bring this round table to a close. And thank you very much, everyone, for listening, and to the co-hosts, John, Deb, Mildred, for contributing to this discussion. And I will encourage you to keep listening, because coming up in the show, we have our regular segments, the Astrology Update and the Living Well segment, plus a very, very interesting interview with our revolutionary guest this month, Dr. Sarah Skifsky. And she is a veterinarian, but she primarily does what's called integrative medicine, which incorporates herbal medicine, homeopathy, acupuncture, Tuina massage, and some other modalities to treat in a much more holistic way pets and animals. So if you have a pet or if you like animals, stay tuned, because I think you will find some very useful information and tips in that. And we'll be right back.
At Firefly Willows LIVE, we're working hard to be your trusted source for fun, enlightening, and heart-centered information and community. And we're passionate about the art of transformative media, the new leading edge of communication in our highly connected, media-rich world. If you're passionate about facilitating change and you have gifts or ideas you'd like to share, come join us. Host a show, or be a guest, or connect us to an amazing speaker or teacher whose message is too good to miss. There's always room for courageous, knowledgeable changemakers, inspired artists, and new ideas. Let us know you're interested. Send an email to info@fireflywillows.com. We're Firefly Willows, LIVE, helping you find and shine your inner light.
Hello, dear listeners, this is James Moran with your astrology update for September 2013. Now, moving into September, what have we? We actually just had, at the end of August, we had Venus go into what's called a grand cross with Jupiter, Uranus, and Pluto. So the Jupiter, Uranus, Pluto T-square, it's called a cardinal T-square, Pluto in Capricorn, Uranus in Aries, Jupiter in Cancer, and then Venus was in Libra. And it created what's called a grand cross. That means as it moved through the zodiac, it went into a 90-degree angle to Pluto, 90-degree angle to Jupiter, 180-degree angle to Uranus, makes a cross across the zodiac, a big X mark, a big cross, very challenging angle, bringing in energies of Venusian energies that get expanded by Jupiter, that get quite empowered and sexualized and impulsive by Pluto and become quite liberated by Uranus, that can equal very impulsive, compelling energies in a few Venusian realms. One is spending. It could be a time of spending in a very large way, that so expansive kind of compulsion to spend a lot. Can also be in the realm of love, kind of a compulsion to feel free in love, incorporate something of broader world in the realm of love, maybe something involving a partner, a new partner, or maybe some new horizon in your partnership, or maybe multiple partners, whatever it may be. We can also have Venus in the realm of art, expanding into new horizons, a sudden desire to get out of the old patterns, free yourself, rebirth your artistic expression. So that was Venus at the end of August, moving into the beginning of September as it passed through Libra. So now, quite a different energy. what I'm going to focus on in this podcast is Venus moves into Scorpio, and Mercury moves into Libra. So Mercury takes that place in the Grand Cross where Venus was. So Mercury is in a Grand Cross with Pluto, Uranus, and Jupiter now. So that is going to be much more having to do with mercurial things like travel, communication, thinking, talking, discussing. It can be a compulsion towards a travel, the compulsion, Pluto, towards freedom, Uranus, to travel, Mercury, to the broader horizon, Jupiter. So it can manifest in the realm of travel for you. It can manifest in the realm of ideas, wanting to feel compelled to free yourself into the broader expanse of bigger ideas, bigger philosophical concepts, bigger discussions. It can be a time to break through the barriers and really speak your mind, speak your truth in a way that perhaps you haven't done before. Write could be having to do with writing, corresponding in a way that is freeing and opens you up to a vaster expanse. So that's Mercury entering into the Grand Cross. Venus goes into Scorpio, and interestingly enough, after that big explosive Grand Cross with Venus at the end of August, we now have, by mid-September, I believe, we will have Mercury going into the Grand Cross, and we'll have Venus going into the Water Trine. Meaning it's going into Scorpio, will be conjoining with Saturn, and will be in a harmonious trine to Neptune, a harmonious trine to Jupiter and Cancer, to Neptune and Pisces. So that Venusian energy that was very much just seized us at the end of August will now become a more smoother, refined energy. It's almost like the cyclical aspect of you can't just go on spending compulsively or broadening your horizons of art or broadening your horizons in love and partnership without eventually that energy converting into something else, something smoother. So as Venus moves into this grand water trine, it's in Scorpio, so Scorpio is a sign of quite a bit of depth, the hidden. Venus in Scorpio likes to go into the muckier side of life and feel the love towards the parts of ourselves that are more steeped in shadow and hidden in the unconscious, and even those parts of humanity outside that are more marginalized into the shadows, the corners, the shadows, the margins of society. That's a Venus in Scorpio kind of feel. But Venus will be conjoined with Saturn. Saturn is quite stabilizing. It is concerned with the past. It's concerned with the truth. So it's actually very grounding. After going through that explosive bout of spending and expanding at the end of August, we now go into a realm by mid-September of being real about the past, real about our love and our grounded ability to love, even in the dark, into the dark corners of our hearts and of others' hearts and of society in general. But it will be in a harmonious angle to Neptune and a harmonious angle to Jupiter. That means that we can have love that is idealized Neptune or is quite expansive Jupiter in a way that is actually quite within the bounds of practicality and within the bounds of usefulness. It's not over-expansive, over-idealized. So, an interesting time for Venus to move from that Venus seized us at the end of August, and now it's moving into a kind of a very flowing state of becoming very real, looking at the past, looking at the realities of life, not shying away from the shadows of life, but still able to keep in our hearts that ideal, that sense that everything is touched by the divine, and that sense of expansive big-heartedness and fairness that comes with Jupiter and the ideal that comes with Neptune and the touch of the divine that comes with Neptune. So it's quite sweet and nice to have that heart grounded, rooted, and yet very open and expansive heart position as Mercury goes into this Grand Cross, because there's going to be quite a lot to talk about and there's going to be quite a lot to see probably in the news. You know, this is the type of aspect that comes up when Edward Snowden, whenever Mercury enters into hard angles with Uranus, Pluto, that's when more stuff comes up about communication in the world and the hidden things and freeing up Uranus, the hidden things, Pluto, through communication, Mercury. So we're bound to see more of that. So the exciting times continue in this, our year, 2013 to 2014, the time of the Great Water Trine, Jupiter, Neptune, Saturn, and of the T-square, Pluto, Uranus, with Jupiter, 2013-2014. Stay tuned for the next installment of the dramatic unfolding of here, life on this Earth, as we are here today, unfolds, it continues to unfold, so we can all enjoy it together, and we can all revel at this divine play that we are both taking part in and that we are actually existing within the fabric of. All right. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great month of September. All right. Thanks for listening, y'all. If you have any questions, I can be reached at jamesmoran.co. That's my website. My email is james@jamesmoran.co. That's James Moran is MORAN.co.co. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful month. Tell me about it. I want to hear. Thank you.
Firefly Willows is proud to support California Animal Rescue in Santa Rosa, California. CAR is a 501c3 nonprofit rescue group dedicated to the rescue of homeless animals from county shelters and off of the streets. They combat the problem of overpopulation through diligent spaying and neutering. CAR consists of a dedicated group of volunteers who rescue animals, provide medical attention, foster them, and place them for adoption. They strive to provide a second chance for those animals that have run out of time at local shelters. For more information or ways that you can help, visit car.rescuegroups.org or like California Animal Rescue on Facebook. This tip of the week from California Animal Rescue. Thinking of fostering an animal in need? When you adopt, you save the life of one animal. But when you become a foster parent, you save the lives of hundreds. It may be sad to part with each foster pet, but the rewards of fostering outweigh everything else. You will be comforted knowing that you have given the greatest gift of all, a second chance at life for a homeless pet. For more information on becoming a foster parent, visit car.rescuegroups.org or like California Animal Rescue on Facebook.
Revolutionary guest this month is Dr. Sarah Skivsky, CEO, President of the Western Dragon, an integrative veterinary consulting business offering alternative medicine opportunities that include holistic medicine, acupuncture, Chinese and Western herbal medicine, food therapy, Bach flower essence, essential oil therapy, and Tui Na massage. Dr. Sarah's mission is helping owners treat their whole pet's individual needs using the most appropriate combination of conventional and alternative medicines. By incorporating the best tools and therapies found in conventional veterinary medicine with the comprehensive perspective of the holistic approach and alternative therapies when appropriate. Dr. Sarah says that to seek holistic medicine for your pet is to begin a journey towards healing and wellness. To find out more about Dr. Sarah's services and to contact her, you can visit her website at www.thewesterndragon.com. So please help me in welcoming to the show today, revolutionary guest, Dr. Sarah Skivsky. So thank you very much for joining us here on the show today, Dr. Sarah.
It's nice. My pleasure.
Nice to have you here. And I know you're going to be talking about some things that many, many people are both interested in and have a vested interest in, because pets are probably more beloved than children for a lot of people. And, you know, you see the statistics now of how much money people spend on their pets. And so obviously it's an area of great interest. So there's a number of different modalities and areas that you particularly focus on in your work working with animals and pets, things like acupuncture, herbal medicine, homeopathy. Those things may be familiar to people, but they often think of them in terms of being used for humans and treating humans for things. So, one, how did you come to start focusing on those and find that that's an important direction to go to work with animals? And then how can those modalities be applied to animals versus what we think of using them with humans?
Well, I actually started my vet degree tracking emergency medicine and doing life-saving techniques and getting in there and saving a pet's life and doing emergency surgeries, things like that. But what I was finding was that the recovery of the patient post-operation, post-life-saving procedure, post-hospitalization, the recovery was not what I liked. I wanted them to recover back to as good as they were before the disease or the accident, or even to something better if they had some type of chronic disease. So I started looking into other things that I could do. I kind of grew up in a house where my mom tried every herbal fad, every herbal, you know, newest thing, and she did all these different things. So I kind of grew up with an idea of that was available, that it was out there already. There are herbs, there are folk medicines that my grandmothers used on us when we were growing up that worked excellently. So I started looking at what could I do to help with healing? You know, how could I help this pet heal to its highest potential to get back on a normal lifespan and having a nice, happy, quality life? Quality is very important. Quantity is great. Quality is better. So I started looking into different things and started doing nutrition first, because after you're born, your immune system, everything that happens with your body is going to come from the nutrition you intake and how your body can utilize that. So I started with nutrition and then started adding herbs in, and starting with Western herbs, Ayurvedic herbs a little bit, and went on to Eastern traditional Chinese medicine herbs, and added essential oils. And after that, then when I moved to California, I got hired at the first vet office that I worked at here, Adobe Animal Hospital, because one, I was an emergency doctor and they needed someone to help cover that. And two, because I already had a knowledge of herbs and that was an up and coming thing 12 years ago. And they wanted to be prepared for that. So that made me go, okay, I should better start learning something more about this, because I've just been kind of winging it. So I looked into where I wanted to solidify my base, where would be a good place to start from that I could branch off from. And from my research, that was traditional Chinese medicine. And they have an aspect that's food therapy, they have herbs, they have acupuncture, they have the Tuina, which is going to be their chiropractic massage, and then they have their Qigong Tai Chi, which is more of their energy medicine. So I was looking at, how am I going to present this to Adobe and get them to pay for it when they asked me to come learn acupuncture? And where would I like to go? I want to go here. So I went and took a class, and now I am certified in all the different animal acupuncture classes. So my certifications are with the Qi Institute and IVIS, which is International Veterinary Acupuncture Society, Colorado, the medical acupuncture, which is a medical acupuncture aspect, and done a little bit for the New Mexico, I can't remember, the Healing Oasis. I've done a couple of their classes. So it stretches the wide variety of completely traditional Chinese medicine, all of the theory and practice with that, to medical applications only, and only Western scientifically proven stuff through Colorado. So I made sure that I could talk to my doctors with my $40 words, but also have a basic understanding of how it worked, and it folded really well into energy and food, and I could bring my Western herbs into that, my essential oils into that, my Bach flowers and flower essences. And I do a tiny bit of homeopathy in that a little bit. So that's kind of how I got started, was I saw something that I felt needed to be done.
And the programs you're talking about that you studied, all of those were specifically for applications with animals?
Those are specifically for applications with animals and specifically for veterinarians. They, like IVIS, the International Veterinary Acupuncture Society, they started in Europe, and there are different types of acupuncture, integrative, herbal medicine. Europe practices a much more integrative system than we do. A lot of the doctors there will actually do herbs and homeopathy along with nutrition right alongside their medicine, and it's not unheard of. And then acupuncture is used a lot in France, and in all of your Asian countries, Korea, Japan, China. India has a very similar type of thing that they do, but it's a chakra-based versus an acupuncture meridian-based type of thing. So it started there with veterinarians saying, hey, you know, we know this is very healing in people, and how can we bring this in and help our pets with that? Then the Qi Institute, which was the first one that I went to in Florida, was started by a fourth-generation herbalist, acupuncturist, first-generation veterinarian. And so he got all of the oral lore and tradition in the classical Chinese way, and then took it and figured out, one, how to start applying it from his point of view to animals, because we already had a couple of things out there, and it just kind of helps consolidate that. And taking some of the old Chinese classics that actually did treat horses and cattle and pig, and they have their own points that are not actually taken from people and then put onto a pet, which are transpositional. So that's the most Chinese of all of the schools. And the IVIS is the middle of the road. They do both Western type of scientific method to the Chinese, and then you have the medical acupuncture, which is very interesting because they can show the science behind the points.
When you mentioned growing up and with your mother and that she would try every herbal fad that came along, I think that that probably is an opportunity to give a word of caution to people to not just believe everything they read on the internet or the latest herbal fad versus to really seek out a professional like you to give them more understanding and some real knowledge about it. Would that be correct, or do you think that people should just, what they read on the internet, give it a try and see what happens?
Well, Dr. Google is very helpful in some cases.
Yes.
But it can actually be detrimental, too. Cats and dogs actually metabolize things a lot differently than we do. And that's why we see where we can take Aleve or Advil or Tylenol, and that will kill a cat, can acutely injure internally a dog because their liver doesn't digest things the same. And because, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, well, it's herb, it's from nature, so therefore it's safe. You know, we have to remember that belladonna is from nature and that foxglove is from nature. And a lot of our great poisons are from nature. And medicines are based off of those, like foxglove gives us digitalis, which we no longer get from the plant. We actually synthesize it in a lab, but it did start there. So chemicals are chemicals, whether they come from a plant or they're manufactured in a lab, they're still going to have an effect. What's the difference between a poison and a cure? Dose. So remembering that a pet digests and works through herbs differently is going to hopefully help you remember not to just give them something. And definitely talking with somebody who has a knowledge, who has worked with herbs and pets, especially in pets, because dogs are carnivorous omnivores and cats are obligate carnivores. That means the bioavailability in plant matter is completely different than a person who is an omnivore. So they intake it completely different along with metabolize it different. So the dosaging is a little bit different. There are a lot of things that you'd be like, oh, well, I've read that they can take this herb and will say, just off the top, echinacea. And that's true. The dose is going to be different. Can you make them sick? Yes, because it's still technically a medicine. It just happens to come from a plant. And dosing dogs and cats are very different than dosing people.
Well, I think that, one, when you're talking about the poisons, that's something that, especially, I don't even know if it's Western versus just American, always think that more is better. And if you worked with the herb of poison, oftentimes it's like you're taking one little drop of it, and that will be very beneficial. But then you take 5 or 10 drops, and suddenly you're killing yourself.
Right.
You know, and I think it's similar even with thinking, like, we might put an essential oil on us. But, and you can correct me on this, but from what I understand, you don't want to necessarily apply an essential oil directly onto the animal because, well, at least for dogs, because I have a little miniature dachshund, because at least the information I read was that their livers don't process it the same way. So it's too intense. The strength of an essential oil can be too strong if you just rub it right onto the skin.
So essential oils are the strongest herbal medicine there is. I mean, if you take 70 pounds of lavender buds, 70 pounds, which is a lot, makes 70 mLs of oil. So here you have this huge amount that you could never ingest, giving you a small amount of liquid. And so it's so completely potent. Essential oils are going to be high in certain types of compounds that we get in minimal amounts that the dog and cat's livers or cytochrome's P450s work completely different in them than they do in us. And especially phenol would be a very good example of one that you could completely harm a pet with because that has a very specific type digestion metabolism in the body. They don't absorb them through their skin as well. We have pores on our skin, and dogs and cats actually only have pores on their nose and their feet. But they are in taking, they'll lick anything off of them. Doesn't matter how bad it tastes, they lick it off. So they actually ingest it, and then it, and as it hits the mouth, the submucosa actually can just dump it right into the bloodstream. So then it's going to hit the liver. And so you can make them acutely ill from that. When I use essential oils in pets, I'm generally doing it in the aromatic fashion. It's in doing the aroma therapies and doing it because their sense of smell is so much stronger than ours too that a little goes a long way. And you're actually inhaling some of that tiny bit of the molecule in, and so you can get some medicine just from inhalation. That's probably in pets where I do the most work. It's going to cause the least amount of problems, and it is usually easy to do. You can do it through a diffuser, a humidifier, a little cotton ball stuffed in their bed, and things like that, something that they can just inhale it, but not on their bodies. I've actually had too many emails and phone calls from emergency doctors besides myself with those pets coming in.
And the reason I brought that up is to also point out that we can't just assume that what works for us as a human is going to work the same way or should be applied the same way to the pets.
Absolutely. You can actually end up making things much worse.
Yes. So what would be the most effective way for people to utilize herbs and things on their own? There's a difference between if their dog is or their pet is having an issue, a mm-hmm. medical issue, and then they would say come to you, and then they're prescribed something the same way we would go to a doctor for something, versus using, say, herbs and things on our own. Is there any way of advising people on how to go about starting to think about and work with herbs and more natural ways of supporting their pets, even through the choice of foods, even using herbs to add to something to help support them?
There are several good body balancing, immune modulating versus immune stimulating types of herbs that are broad spectrum enough that can be used 90% of the time without any problems. And the answer will never be 100% of the time it would be okay, because every pet, like every person, is completely different. First of all, you can have an allergy to it. which means it's not actually going to be helpful. Or you could just, it just is not going to work well for that pet's constitution or problem, even though in general it does work for that type of issue. Probably straight across the board in moderation for things that you could find on Dr. Google would be things like milk thistle. It's a very good antioxidant. Any type of liver issues you can probably deal with. Tastes nasty, and just putting in a pet's food, probably not going to eat it. The medicinal mushrooms are relatively good straight across the board for keeping healthy. When asked if there's any one thing you should be taking all the time, and I'm not a big person for taking any type of supplement regularly, it would be a medicinal mushroom. They're just awesome, great. They're balancing straight through and help the immune system. And so those are pretty safe to give straight across the board. A good vitamin mineral product that's based on whole foods is a good idea, because dog foods and cat foods, pet foods in general, only have the minimal daily requirement required for pets for a healthy pet to stay healthy. So if your pet's going through anything, there's not enough actual vitamin and mineral to help them get through something. So they have to go on their reserves until they can get through whatever flu, virus, allergy problems that they may or may not be having, because the amount of vitamins and minerals in the food are minimal to keep a healthy pet healthy, not anything to help older pets or younger pets. The same with your vitamin supplements. They're minimal daily doses to help keep a pet healthy. So when you add those two, you're right about a good place for vitamins and minerals, especially in geriatric and pediatric pets and chronic illnesses. And if it's just a straight across whole food vitamin mineral. And the two that I actually use, and I don't sell it, I don't own stock in the company, are generally C-Meal by Solid Gold or Missing Link product by Designing Health, because those are whole food ones. And I use them for very specific types of issues. The C-Meal is very cooling from the ocean, kelps, probiotics, prebiotics. And the Missing Link uses Brewer's yeast, so it's a warming formula, so those older animals that are colder. But if you have skin conditions, especially fungal problems, that may be a problem, because they use a yeast product to get their minerals and their B vitamins out of. Those probably straight across the board are good. Local honey, anytime during allergy season, for those animals that seem to be dry and itchy, you can do coconut oil will help with that. Stay away from seed oils, because they can't digest seeds, being carnivorous, omnivores, and obligate carnivores. Their body has no way to digest seed products. So even though we're like, ooh, yum, borage, primrose oil, hemp, flax seed, chia seed, our bodies are set for that. Our teeth can grind them and we can get at them. They can't. So you're going to look at things like coconut oil, avocado oil, olive oil, in moderation, of course, to help with moisturizing. The best, of course, would be animal-based ones, because they are meat eaters. So things like cod liver oil, salmon body oil, egg yolk is a good one. And
these are talking about applying externally, or this is something you'd be adding to the food for them to be taking internally?
That would be internally. You would add a little bit to the food to help with that. You know, the oils are going to generally help with the drier skin, the drier nose, and help moisturize. But a lot of times when we see something, we think moisture and we think water. But even though we are 90% water, we also have a lot of oils. We make oils for our skin to help with the dry skin, itching, stuff like that. They make oils also. And actually, oily skin in a pet a lot of times is an oil issue.
So we're doing this interview from your office in San Jose, California. And I know right outside of the door, you have your own herb garden where you grow many different herbs and things. And then you actually use and package many of those up to administer in your practice. And then you also have shelves of many other herbs as well that you don't necessarily grow on your own. If someone was starting to think about incorporating herbs and that kind of thing, do you have suggestions on how to go about identifying good herbs, that not good in terms of which herbs to use, but good herbs in terms of harvesting practices and that kind of thing?
Generally, seasonal herbs treat seasonal problems. So as things are blooming, and coming up, depending on which herb you're looking at. And let's start with valerian. Valerian root is used a lot for in people, and you can use it in pets if you can get past the smell of it, for just kind of that tranquility. It doesn't actually have too much of a sedation. It just kind of has that everything's going to be okay type of quality. The time that it grows will also help determine a lot of the times that we use it. Because you use the root, you're going to use that more in the fall. And a lot of pets have anxiety and problems with when it starts getting dark and raining and noises. And that's when we see a lot more of the anxiety start to come up. And then that plant has put all of its energy back in its root, and that root is ready to harvest. It grows at the time when we need the root. That plant has put all of its energy in the root. Another example would be something like lemon balm. Lemon balm and nettles. Stinging nettle is a weed for most people, but it's one of the most medicinal plants you can ever find. They both bloom in spring, and they both help with allergies. Lemon balm has a wider variety of things it can help with, but because it starts blooming in spring and all of the energy is going up into that leaf, and nettles, same way. Generally, when I see my nettles start growing in January, I can have a pretty good idea of how bad the allergy season is going to be, because the amount that I see in my yard usually is almost directly proportional to how bad the allergies are going to be. And I start harvesting them. And they're gone by the time of the middle of spring. So they come up, they're there to treat that type of a problem at that point, and then they're gone. Elderberries, elderflowers. The elderberries are going to be coming up. The flowers come first in summer, and then the berries come out, and those are come in time to make tinctures and stuff for fall. They're the best cold and flu types of tinctures. So you have time to not only collect them, but then to use them to go into a product for when you need it. So they come up, like I said, summer, then you collect them, and by the time you make your tincture, oh, fall's here, and that's flu cold season, and that's what's used best for that. So seasonal herbs are the easiest. Getting started, I would, you know, there's a couple of good books out there about that show pictures and what to look for, what time of year they grow, what types of things. Local is going to be better too, because they're going to have the energy of the area you live in and help deal with the things that are going on. And generally, when I'm using herbs from my yard and adding them to formulas that I have on my shelf, I'm adding in a herb to add the energy of San Jose area, the Bay Area, and to help that medicine work better. Because the stuff in the bottles don't have that energy pull to help deal with the diseases of this area. They are straight across the board. This fixes that very cookbook, which is great 75% of the time.
I think that's similar to honey. It's like if you have pollen allergies, eating local honey is what helps with that. So sure, honey from France may taste great,
right,
but it's not going to have the same pollen, so it's not going to be very medicinally beneficial for your allergies if you're living in the middle of the United States. So obviously it's the same application for
very,
any
very
of
similar
herb.
Absolutely.
And if people were trying to seek out packaged herbs already, are there any criteria or things that you would suggest to look out for in order to be able to identify a quality product, a good herb, a good company versus just anybody selling an herb?
Well, a lot of my formulas on my shelves are for practitioners only, because they are for very specific types of patterns and or diseases, and giving them to the wrong disease or pattern is actually going to be detrimental to the healing. There are a couple of companies out there that have a good type of, you are looking for something for kennel cough, which is a bronchitis in dogs. Animal Apothecary has a good type of write-up, things to look for. It's a general medication, very cookbook, so it'll work 75% of the time. What I look for is the National Animal Supplement, NASC, because they've actually gone through and certified these different companies. One, that they don't have anything that's going to outrightly poison a pet. And two, been through the formulas to make sure that what they're saying is actually what they're treating. A lot of pet products don't have that. And a lot of them have these proprietary blends. And I understand that when you're an herbalist and you have this awesome blend that is working so well, you don't want to give away your secrets. But when you have another person working with that pet and that pet's not getting well, it doesn't help the practitioner not to know what herbs are in it, because you can have interactions with herbs just like you can have interactions with medicine. And in fact, you can have interactions with herbs to medicines. So I generally stay away from proprietary blends. You know, if I don't know what's in it, I'm going to be, yeah, what if it's going to interact with something that they have to take down the road? Some will interact, and it's very rare that an herb is going to interact with a food, but there are some that do interact with certain types of food, with fishes and dairy and things like that. So generally, I kind of stay away from proprietary blends. And it's not that they don't work. It's just that I don't know exactly what I'm dealing with. And I know that they work. I have clients that use them, and I just tell them I don't have an opinion on that because I don't know what's in it.
And I think it's the same for humans because, you know, at least my approach is I will look at an ingredients list, and if there's anything I don't know how to pronounce or I don't know what it is, then I'm like, then I don't know that I need to be ingesting that, because
absolutely,
if they can't, you know, list either the common name, so I would at least know what it is, because a lot of times it's just like a really scientific
mm-hmm.
name, but even still, or if they just use some catch-all. You
right.
know, natural flavors or mm. fragrance or something like
scary.
That. Yeah. You know, but if they're not going to tell me what's in it, it's the whole thing, like GMO labeling.
Yeah.
Like, why are people so afraid of labels, just so we would be informed and be able to make the choice?
Absolutely.
You know, but I think people need to think about applying that same kind of thing for their pets. You know, and I know you've said that probably the most important thing is food that we feed to the pet.
Mm-hmm.
How would you recommend people choosing a good food? And maybe it's easier sometimes to say, here's what to look for that you don't want in a food, so avoid foods that have these kinds of things in them.
That's a very interesting question. Yeah. In China, food is their primary medicine. And so they focus on food, and then they add acupuncture and then add herbs if they need it. Food and exercise are the top of their medicine tier. In general with foods, I would say that you would need to remember what your pets are. If you have a dog, you have a carnivorous omnivore. If you have a cat, you have an obligate carnivore. These two animals thrive on animal protein and animal fats. The other thing that I don't think is common knowledge, it may be a little bit of common sense if we actually sit and think about it, we go, oh, yeah, is that kibble is actually pretty rough and really hard on pets. Something that a lot of people don't know about kibble is whether it has grains in it or not, it has to be 50% carbohydrates in order to be extruded to form a kibble. So grain or no grain, you have 50% carbohydrate, which is coming from a non-animal product. So there you have 50% of the food that is not animal-based and is not going to be adding a lot to the health. Then kibble has to be heat fixed. It has to be heat fixed so when you open up that bag of kibble, it doesn't mold in 3 or 4 days if you live in the Gulf Coast. It stays and kind of holds its form and is tough against molding and going rancid quickly. And that heat fixing makes it actually very, very hard to digest. And it gets in that stomach and it just kind of sits there, and the body has to keep dumping digestive fluids in there to try to get it to digest, which makes them dehydrated. Then they drink water, but water doesn't replace those fluids, so they have to build those fluids. So they're constantly in a state of dehydration, building fluids. And so it's very high energy expenditure for food. It doesn't mean that some pets do well on it. It just means those pets would do better if they had a more hydrating type of food. In our economy, that's kind of hard to do for a lot of people, because canned food, which is automatically higher in animal proteins and fats because carbs would make those cans swell and get bad quicker, is more expensive. So a lot of people turn for the ease of feeding, and it's not stinky, and for price to dry foods. Those, in my opinion, are the hardest on the body. You can hydrate them until they start to pup to break down that heat fixing, and that will help. It doesn't have to be soggy. Cats don't really like hydrated foods. Dogs are usually like, cool, gravy.
Yeah.
Cats, in general, I would say, food-wise, canned food. Cats are desert creatures. They're supposed to get all of their food from their food. And they used to teach in vet schools that if you saw a cat drinking water, take them in and test them for kidney failure. Nowadays, they don't say that. They say if you see them drinking a lot, you should take them in. But they have to drink now because most of our cats are on dry food. They have to replace that fluid. So now we're seeing a lot more kidney failure because they're cats, which are completely different from dogs and people in how they metabolize water in their body. We do it through our kidneys. They do it through their colon. Cats are one of the only animals that can actually take fluid back out of their bladder once it's been in there. They can kind of recycle it, and that's why they can get that really syrupy, crystal, yucky-smelling cat pee, because they can just say, yeah, I need more fluid, and they can pull it back out. When they drink a lot of water, they have to use their kidneys to do it. When they get water from their food, they use their colon. And so that's what cats are supposed to be doing. And we see a lot more kidney failure because cats are drinking a lot more water than they normally do. So across the board, cats should be on some type of canned food. Friskies, the cheapest thing you get, is better than the highest quality dry food, in my opinion. I would prefer them on a canned to dry. Dogs, a good quality food, hydrated if you're doing dry, do canned if you can. And generally grain-free, dogs and cats don't really eat grains. Their teeth are not made for that. They have grabbing teeth in the front, cutting teeth on the sides, not flat teeth for grinding. And if anybody's seen a cat or a dog eat, they're kind of looking like dogs are usually sucking it in like a vacuum cleaner, and cats look like they're juggling food in their mouth. And should they throw it up, which is not uncommon with dry food, it doesn't look like they even chewed it because they don't have flat teeth for chewing. They're just trying to get it down their gullet, and that's how their mouths are shaped, for grabbing, ripping, chewing, swallowing, chunks of just big, small enough to swallow. Those would, are my general guidelines. Other than that, you're going to be looking at things that you're reading in the food that you don't know what the words are, as additives, staying away from preservatives that have funky names. They're getting a lot better about the preservatives in dog and cat food. People get hung up on byproducts and things like that. And yes, feathers are byproducts. Beaks are byproducts. But so are organs, and a lot of organs are very good ways of getting vitamins and minerals into cats and dogs. So I think that if they are having their byproducts in there, good companies name them. They tell you our byproducts are liver, heart, spleen, pancreas. It's something that is actually how they're getting their food-based vitamins and minerals in. Those are my general rules of thumb for cat and dog food.
Well, to move from some of the more practical side of things to some of the more energetic, esoteric aspects of things. My first question to you actually would be, have you always been drawn to or connected to animals, or was there something that happened or at some point in your life where you suddenly felt a connection to animals and wanted to go that direction for what you wanted to do?
No, I've always been connected to animals. I have pictures of me hauling in things and patching them up since I was 3 or 4. So that is something that they have a very strong empathic type of a thing with pets. I can feel a lot of times what emotional state would probably be the wrong. I can, when they come into my office, I can feel if they're petrified and have an intuition to help them settle. And I can feel different aspects by looking and petting and doing my exam to help them calm down. And that's something that I didn't know other people didn't have, because I grew up with it. And being able to catch an injured rabbit or bird, I thought that was something everybody did, because it was not that hard. you know, the injured ones I have always been able to go up to and collect and then work with. And my parents have always said I was going to be a vet. They were hoping for something else. But they did say, we knew you were going to end up being a vet.
And I think you find that with a lot of people, because you'll hear people that are, say, psychics or mediums or that kind of thing. And very often you'll hear when they were a kid, you know, that they would see spirits and talk to them. But they thought everybody saw those and everybody, you know, did that. And
doesn't every kid think, well, everybody's just like me?
Right.
It's definitely difficult in certain areas and certain times of your life because it's freaky or weird. And I did have it try to be like, that's not really that way. You know, you're talking to the animal again. I can't help it. I mean, I know they're not talking back to me, but it makes me feel better to talk to them. And in vet school, I really think that, you know, they really try to just really squish that out of you and become more scientific and then not trust your intuition, not trust your interaction with the pet. You are, you know, cookbooking it, definitely. This is scientific method, and this is one sign, that's another sign. Open the book, A plus B equals C, there you go. And that works some of the time. It just doesn't work enough of the time for me.
But isn't that the classic difference between Western and Eastern medicine? Yep. Is, you know, put symptom A plus symptom B equals C. Now treat this, which is really treating those symptoms.
Right. And not treating the patient.
Looking at, yeah, the patient and saying, where is the root of this coming from? And, you know, your stomach ailment may be coming from your liver, and this person's stomach ailment may be coming from their lungs. Therefore, we're going to treat you completely differently rather than Western medicine. Often we'll just give the same thing because it's the same symptom of the stomach.
Right. One of the very important things that I always encourage my clients to do, and I encourage people who are owners and caregivers of those wonderful souls that have come into our life, is your doctor is your library. That's it. They are there to help you, the caregiver, nurse, doctor, who's actually doing the work. You take them into a doctor, whether it be holistic, Western, whatever your flavor, for 30 minutes, an hour at the most, out of a 2-week, 3-week, once a month, maybe on occasion once a week type of a thing. That gives them a snapshot of that pet. And pets get excited or stressed going to a new place, which is actually going to change a lot of how they're acting. So you, as a parent, an owner of that family member, that little soul, need to be very proactive. And you have to realize that, yeah, we have a snapshot that we're working from. A lot of doctors do not like to be talked to that way. But when you think about it, you can see how that you have more insight into your pet than a person could that is meeting them for at most an hour every week would have into it. And the more information that is gotten and interaction with your library or your doctor is going to be better. I have clients come in and I ask them a question and they don't want to give me bad news. I'm like, so how's everything going? It's going okay. And I always tell them, I can't fix the problem if I don't know it. And I know that you think you're giving me bad news, but you're just actually giving me information. It's not personal. And so I see a lot of people not realizing how important their role is in that soul's care.
But I think that's another thing that people have often had drilled out of them, is trusting that in themselves to know that, versus the trust is in the doctor. And so the doctor will know better, I don't, and therefore we stop trusting what we are able to observe ourselves and that intuitive sense of what might be wrong or what might not be, even though in other cases it may be a problem, but that's because it was a sudden flare-up of something versus something we've seen that's just a regular thing that happens.
Well, it gets back to the A plus B equals C. A lot of conventional medicine is very based on, you are a car, something's broken, and I'm going to fix it, which is not really how the body works. Everybody has an innate ability to heal itself. It just needs the right pieces to help heal that immune system so then it can go forward. And that's why you see people having reactions to medicine. Medicine's not working. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, because they are treating the diagnosis and not the patient. And one of my things that I get from conventional doctors all the time is, well, it could just be a placebo effect. And I'm like, you forget, I believe in that.
Yeah.
Because I believe the body can heal. I believe the mind can heal the body. And that's what a placebo effect is. I'm like, great. Yeah. And we've just proven the mind can heal the body. Way to go. They're better. I'm happy.
Because usually the placebo effect is just getting the mind or the body past its own fear or stress or anxiety around the issue, which is probably creating the block. And if it suddenly helps to dissolve the block, then the body can go into doing what it would do anyway. And that's still a healing process. And the placebo effect, I think, is perhaps, just like you said, mm-hmm. a very beneficial part of that process when it works that way.
A lot of the alternative, holistic modalities very much believe that emotions and emotional states influence. You know, it's dis-ease. You are not at ease. And so then it develops. And so getting through those blocks a lot of times, if it's early enough in that dis-ease, you can heal more quickly without having to have intervention.
And I think the use of herbs and things like that, different from, say, using medicines, like Western medication kind of medicines, is the herbs and things are supporting the body in doing what it does naturally and giving it that little extra piece or extra boost that it needs versus the medicine, which is almost like doing it for the body, but may then not be doing it in harmony with how the body would do it itself.
Or even doing it to the body. You should realize that 90% of our medicines that are on shelves today that are actually chemically synthesized in a lab were derived from plants. One of the biggest difference between a medication and an herb or an herbal formula is going to be the amount of constituents present. The medication is one active ingredient synthesized to be an exact dose. An herb is going to have fluctuating amounts of constituents, including that active ingredient. These constituents are going to fluctuate with the ground, the energy, the season, which make it more potent for treating those types of problems that are coming. You know, the plant prepares for that. Also, you have the energy. You have a life energy that is involved in that. So there is on an energetic base, and homeopathy takes that to the nth, but the herbal medicine is going to still have that energy in it. It's going to have that ability to help balance from an energetic standpoint and help the body get that spiritual, energetic type of portion under control so you have mind, body, and spirit working together again.
And from what I understand, herbs actually work better in combination with each other rather than just a single herb.
It depends on the problem and also the herb. A lot of times, and it depends on the modality, like Chinese medicine, most of them are formulas. Ayurvedic, they're mostly formulas. Western herbs are actually used more like conventional medications. Oh, you have a fever, here's feverfew. Hay fever, feverfew. And it's generally one herb versus a combination herbs. Native Americans do 1 to 4 herbal combination types of things. But it's not unheard of for them to use a single herb at a time. And that's a very Western herbal type of thing. There are a couple of, in Chinese medicine, that they do single herbs for times. It's just rare. Combinations of herbs let you use less of one herb, form a synergistic, hit more things at one time. And that's why Chinese use formulations. So if you have a dog that has arthritis and ear infections, and low kidney values, you can pick a formula that's going to treat all three of those at the same time versus it's arthritis, I'm going to give you yucca or boswellia or, you know, just an anti-inflammatory. And then you have to use a higher dose of a single herb. where if you use them in combination, the synergistic effect is greater at lower doses of each herb.
You had referred earlier to the souls that have come into our lives for our care and as part of our family and things. And a lot of people have heard the term or are familiar with things like animal totems or animal spirit guides. And I wonder if you just have any thought on what or if you think there is any difference between the physical animal that comes into our life versus the spirit animal or the energy of an animal guide or an animal totem. And should we just equate the two, or should we see them as kind of different types of entities or beings, the same way we would think of, you know, angels or ghosts or spirit guides as different than a physical person that comes into our life and may also provide us guidance or assistance?
That's a good question. I think a lot of times when you look at animal spirits and animal totems, you are looking at animals that have actually been around a lot longer than domesticated cats and dogs. That's a relatively new development. We do have cats in Egypt back thousands of years, not really domesticated, worshipped as gods. But in dogs, that is relatively new. I mean, wolves we've had, which are related to dogs, but the actual canines that we have here have not been around as long as the idea of a spirit animal or a totem animal. Could the pet that you have be that? I think that the answer to that would be absolutely. I don't see that as often with the people who do a lot of energy work that happen to be clients and such. And in my own life, I, you know, things that speak to me on an intuition and help me in my daily practice and in my daily life for me are not my household pets, so they're there to love me and take care of me. But on a more spiritual level, they are different totems and different spirit guides and change. Our pets aren't Kleenex. We're not going to be changing them all the time. And we have the ability to work with different spirit guides and spirit totems, animals, otherwise, because plants can also be that way, to help us through a specific instance. Some we can keep for a lifetime, some we need on only a certain part of our path, and they come into our lives and then leave. We're hoping we're not doing that with our pets. we are taking care of those little souls and not treating them that way. And they're there for unconditional love and support and to help us on those levels where when our spirit needs that or our soul, a lot of times you have something that comes into your life to fulfill that need. So that's why I think that you don't see it as often that a pet is that person's spirit animal totem or anything like that. I definitely have had cats. Have they been my cats? One of them, but he's passed, and it didn't happen until he passed.
And I think that animals that come into our lives in physical form are there as teachers, whereas animal totems and animal spirit guides are there as guides.
Absolutely. A lot of times the animals come in to teach that lesson that we are not realizing that we haven't learned yet. The ones that we keep repeating and repeating and repeating, and then an animal steps into the life and teaches the lesson, sometimes in an obtuse way, coming around the back, but teaching the lesson all the same. They are often very much reflections of us and, you know, put that mirror in front of our face. Even in diseases that they have, a lot of times when I have a new client and I'm going over something, I just have them sitting there with their mouth hanging open. They're like, that's what I have. Like, well, and you learn a lot in taking care of yourself by caring for another. So they get to learn also how to take care of themselves and questions that they can ask to be more interactive and responsible for their own health.
Well, and I was even thinking even universally, I think that animals come into people's lives in physical form to help teach the lesson of unconditional love.
Absolutely. And there are people who have not learned to hear the small voice. And so learning that way, or even being guided by a spirit guide or an animal totem, is going to be something they can't hear at that point. And when you have a animal come in that is teaching you unconditional love and a lot of different things, you start to hear that. I have clients who tell me no, and I'm like, you can't tell me that you're not standing in your kitchen one time and your pet walks in and you turn around and you're like, it's not time to eat right now. And all they did was walk into the kitchen. And that you're starting to tune in that aspect of you, that you can walk in to wherever your pet's sitting, look at them, and then you're like, no, I'm not going to sit down and spend 15 minutes petting you right now. And it is something that sounds completely silly, but when you have a pet, it's completely natural. It's something that ends up happening.
And often surprises you.
Right.
You become that attuned if you pay attention.
Which is why it's important to be very responsible and proactive with your doctor, no matter how much they love or hate.
Right.
Because you do get that fine-tuning of living with that being that you learn about them. And my oldest cat here is deaf. She's been deaf her whole life. She was born without an inner ear. And I talk to her constantly. She always floors my husband when I happen to be at Adobe and coming back. She runs to the front door 5-10 minutes before I'm here, sitting, screaming, waiting, and completely deaf. I mean, in 5 or 10 minutes is much further than she would ever be able to hear the car if she could hear it, but she always knows. And it's very interesting.
Right. And I think that's another one of those kind of universal lessons that pets, perhaps in their physical form, have come to teach us, is to also awaken in us that deeper abilities that we also have to connect, to be able to hear on other levels, to see on other levels, to sense, you know, on other levels. And if we pay attention to how we're doing that with them, we can then apply that to our broader life.
Absolutely.
And have a bit more trust in that and know that possible and that we are capable of doing that versus doubting that or turning that part of ourselves off.
Well, I think that sometimes people are expecting if I open myself up and do this, I'm going to become the animal communicator.
Yeah.
And that's not everybody's gift. I think that's something that everybody has, especially with their own pet.
Right.
A lot of times people don't have that with other animals that they meet, but something you learn with your pet.
But I think people can apply that more broadly, because you might be able to do that with your pet, but not with everybody.
Absolutely.
But you can also then apply that and say, but I can also do that with my life.
Uh-huh.
And even though I couldn't be, you know, a medium or a communicator of some sort for everybody's life on the psychic way.
It's old quickly.
It would. But that doesn't mean that we can't trust and apply it to our own life and know that we have that ability in our own life. Because we have the most intimate experience of our life, you know, and so instead, but well, often people end up going and asking for the advice of others,
right,
for their life versus trusting their own sense.
And sometimes that's sensible, I would think. Other times, I think that it is, you are responsible for your life. You better learn to give yourself good advice. You know, failures are experience. That's all they are. When you have a failure, you've learned something, hopefully, or you will experience it again. And those become your life lessons, and those focus and teach your small voice. Also, they taught you that you weren't listening to it a lot of times.
So as we go into the fall season, is there any tip or two just generally that you might offer to people that is a common thing to watch out for or just to do for their pet for that particular season?
Well, in people, we know this is the big time for colds and flus. And dogs and cats can get flus and little viruses too. So helping stabilize the immune system is always a good idea when you're coming into fall. You're going to have extreme weather change. You're going to go from nice and hot, and when it finally starts raining, it's going to become cold and wet. And so that can definitely tweak the immune system. So, you know, we talked a little bit about the medicinal mushrooms. Those are usually very helpful during that time. We also talked a little bit about elderberry and elderflower, which are really good at stabilizing the immune system, especially against flus and viruses. And those are pretty good, broad spectrum, hard to hurt yourself or your pet things that you could do. Good foods, and especially dogs and cats, being animal-based type of eaters. A lot of times liver, a little extra liver, whether it's a freeze-dried only liver treat a couple times a week. Even cats will sometimes eat that just to help give the vitamins that help support the immune system. And from a glandular standpoint, which is a type of medicine where you feed a gland to help heal a gland, liver actually makes up most of your cells for your immune system. It doesn't make them all the time, but it is actually made so it can make almost every single one of them. Your immunoglobulins, your antibodies, it can even make some of your different white blood cells, your red blood cells if it needs to. So giving a little bit extra of liver will help your body kind of stabilize out. You can eat it yourself if you like it. A lot of people don't. But it's high in vitamin A and vitamin D and a lot of your antioxidant types of things. So it's a good thing, and it's very bioavailable to dogs and cats. Again, moderation is key, as in all things. You feed them too much liver and you'll be dealing with diarrhea. But a little bit, a couple times a week, just to help boost that would be good. It would be easier to help the immune system that way than doing the mushrooms, which dogs and cats have a natural aversion to because they can't tell poisonous ones. And it's going to be more bioavailable than even the elderflowers and elderberries, which some dogs would be like, cool, and cats would be like, what are you feeding me? So, you know, food therapy, of course, is going to be great, liver being that. Freeze-dried lung would be good also. In Chinese medicine, the lung is... that lung meridian is the immune system meridian. So those types of things. And there are a couple of good websites that sell freeze-dried organ products. The one that comes to mind right now is onlynaturalpet.com.
And if for like the elderberry and that kind of thing, would you just buy the same herb as if I was going to get that to, say, make my own tea and then just mix a little into the food?
You probably could do that with elderberry. And generally for dogs and cats, I say get the children's formula because they're going to be a little bit less potent, per se, and harder to overdose. It would be really hard to overdose on mushrooms or elderberry and anyway, but it just gives you something easier to work with. And the dose is going to depend on what size animal that you have. But there are, like I said, there are some references that you can find for that. And like the one that I mentioned, like I think Animal Apothecary with a paw, P-A-W, theory, it may even have an echinacea type of a thing that you can get. I'm not echinacea, elderberry.
So that would be some place you could go to where you would specifically be buying the supplement for pets,
right,
rather than buying, say, your own supplement and then trying to find the right dosage someplace.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's just to clarify, there are things that are actually made specifically for pets in the whole herbal range. You just kind of have to do a search to find the places that offer those kind of things.
Yeah.
Is this type of practice something that is pretty well regarded and well accepted, and do we find it across the country, or do you find that it's really more local in certain areas?
It is a little niche type of clinic. There are more coming up around, and it's becoming more common of a practice. But it is not all around the country. There are places that have a practitioner at their clinic that does it. There is a website called holisticvetlist.com, that lists by area code or zip code, whichever one you want, different vets around the United States that have been licensed, certified for different modalities. They list everything from chiropractic to Bach flower, nutrition, acupuncture, food therapy, tweenot. I mean, you can pick and choose which ones you want. How good they will be, I don't know, because there are levels of certification. There's some certifications that are one-day classes and some of them that are a year and a half course. So that part is use your intuition.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it lists what certifications they have, and then you can look up the certifications. And then all of the schools, I don't know if Ivis does, but I know Qi Institute, which is TCVM.com, which stands for Traditional Chinese Veterinary Medicine, they also have a list of people who've graduated from their classes that are now practicing, and it lists whether they do acupuncture, herbal medicine, Tui Na, food therapy.
To close each interview, there's two questions that I always ask. And one of those is a question that my previous guest from last month will have given for you. They didn't know who would be my guest, but it was their question for the next guest to come on. And then you ask a question that you would like for the following guest next month to respond to. First, I'll ask you if you have a question for the guest next month.
Why does your favorite color speak to you?
And then the question from last month, my guest was H.R. Bremner, who is a sexological body worker, and we talk about sex and intimacy and relationships and things. His question for you was, what is it that you do for yourself that gives you the greatest pleasure?
Cooking. It's very therapeutic. It just, I lose myself in it. Gardening would probably be second, but cooking definitely is it. Because I don't get a lot of time to cook, but it definitely, I lose myself in my mind, and my brain can just, it's creating. And so that's one of my favorite things to take a mini vacation in my house and cook.
Well, thank you very much for joining us and spending
time.
And perhaps you can remind people, if they were interested in your services, how they can contact you, where they can find information about you.
The best way to get in touch with me would be through email or my website. My email address is my business name, thewesterndragon@mac.com. And then my website is www.thewesterndragon.com. And it does have a link on it, so it'll email me. You can email me right from the website, or you can just email me directly.
And I know on your website, for anyone listening, that there is also additional information about holistic medicine, holistic versus natural, some of the different modalities and what they entail and that kind of thing. So that's also a really good resource for people if they were curious. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For doing this. And stay tuned, because coming up we'll have our Living Well segment, and we'll be right back with that.
Tarot reading can offer you insight, information, enlightenment, and empowerment along your life's path. Hi C is a professional tarot conversationalist and ritualist with over 10 years' experience. He's available for readings in a variety of formats, including parties and events. To schedule your personal tarot reading, contact Hi C at tarotbyhic.net or email him at hic@fireflywillows.com.
I am Linda Wiley, and this is Living Well with Linda. Your monthly guide to the well-being of your body, mind, and spirit. It's about an alternative approach to life, healing, and living well in our changing world. Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food. A return to this understanding of the truth of food and the value of food within our lives. Our body is a machine for living. It is organized for that. It is its nature. Let life go on in it, unhindered, and let it defend itself. It will do more than if you paralyze it by encumbering it with remedies. Leo Tolstoy, War and Peace. To realize our connection with all of life and the plant and animal kingdom and how we support and help each other in our process. I am Linda Wiley, and this is Living Well with Linda. In an increasingly urbanized world, is the spirit and mystery of nature still even relevant? Or is the land little more than a resource, a source of energy and the minerals we need to contrive our fabricated cities and technologicalized lives? A life lived close to the earth keeps us tuned in to what is real and important. Happiness comes of a life lived in balance. It is rooted in good friends, good family, sustainable lives, and spiritual fulfillment. Yet it is all too easy to lose track of these things if one is alienated from the living world and its sacred magic that energizes and enlightens our spirits. The natural world is enchanted, powerful, healing, and ultimately vital to our well-being. It does far more than just give us food and resources. It is full of mystery and powerful spirituality. Nature, experienced close and firsthand, makes magic come alive and gives life to endless, numinous, and enchanted possibilities. In the city, it's all concrete and logic, but here in the wild country, it's something deeper. Nature is a wellspring of enchantment and spirit, half forgotten in the era of growing urban tangle. But nature is the source of health of body, mind,
but
and spirit.
But nature is the source of health of body, mind, and spirit.
And we would do well to keep close to it. As the great Cherokee Ellie Gatoga has said, all truth can be found in nature, and then you know. You know the unfathomable depths of mystery concealed so elegantly in these otherwise simple natural events in a way that goes beyond words, yet profoundly reshapes your life. The trees, the grass, the animals, the brooks and the sea, the earth and the sky have much to teach any who will look to them. There is magic and wonder beyond your door. There is magic and wonder beyond your door, and it is happy to enrich you if you will walk its way. Oh, September has arrived in all its splendor. Fall begins as we notice the changing colors in the trees, as they show us how to draw our life force within and conserve that precious juice for spring's arrival and sustenance through the approaching winter. And the turning within begins as well, as the days shorten and the coolness feels good as this time progresses towards the deepening, darker months of the year. But for now, we celebrate the fullness summer has brought in so many ways. The sun filling the body with health and well-being will be used as the winter descends, and we need all the warmth we can find. All the best food fills our bodies now with goodness and strength and the joy of fullness only summer can offer. We remember that nature is the teacher, and this is the way forward for life to thrive. So in the ways of old, may Bon, as this month is called, is also the autumn equinox. The autumn equinox divides the day and the night equally, and we all take a moment to pay our respects to the impending dark. We also give thanks to the waning sunlight as we store our harvest of this year's crops. We honor the green man, the god of the forest, by offering libations to trees. Offerings of ciders, wines, herbs, and fertilizers are appropriate this time. Wiccans celebrate the aging goddess as she passes from mother to crone, and her consort, the god, as he prepares for death and rebirth. At this festival, it is appropriate to wear all your finery and dine and celebrate in a lavish setting. It is the drawing to and of family as we prepare for the winding down of the year at Savna. It is time to finish old business as we're ready for a period of rest, relaxation, and reflection. Some of the symbols of Mabon would be the second harvest, the mysteries, equality and balance, and the equinox is on Sunday, September 22nd this year. The symbols are wine, gourds, pine cones, acorns, grains, corn, apples, pomegranates, vines such as ivy, dried seeds and pods, and horns of plenty. Herbs of the season are acorn, ferns, grains, honeysuckle, marigold, milkweed, myrrh, passionflower, rose, sage, Solomon's seal, tobacco, thistle, and vegetable. Foods of this season are breads, nuts, apples, pomegranates, and vegetables such as potatoes, carrots, and onions. The colors are red, orange, russets, maroon, brown, and gold, the stones being sapphire, lapis lazuli, and yellow agate. Just imagine how, I mean, to me, those colors are so beautiful together, the russets and the deep blues, they're beautiful together. Making wine and ciders as offerings to the green man, gathering dried herbs, plants, seeds, seed pods, walking in the woods, scattering offerings in harvested fields, offering libations to trees, adorning burial sites with leaves, acorns, and pine cones to honor those who have passed. Be creative. It's really fun. Just imagine making a table arrangement with all the ingredients, the acorns, the gourds, the pine cones, leaves. It's a beautiful endeavor. Put it on your table and honor the season. Spell workings would be for protection, prosperity, security, and self-confidence. Also those of harmony and balance. The deities of Mabon, the goddesses would be Madryn, Morgan, Epona, Persephone, Pomona, and the muses. The gods of this season are Mabon, Thoth, Thor, Hermes, and the Green Man. Mabon is considered a time of the mysteries. It is time to honor aging deities of the spirit world. It is considered a time of balance. It is when we stop and relax and enjoy the fruits of our personal harvest, whether they be from toiling in our gardens, working at our jobs, raising our families, or just coping with the hustle and bustle of everyday life. May your Mabon be memorable and your hearts and spirits be filled to overflowing. Some books I would like to recommend. One that I have used and relied upon for this session here is Seasons of the Sacred Earth, Following the Old Ways of an Enchanted Homestead by Cliff Serantine, Seruntine. Great book filled with wonderful traditional old information that would do us well to take up again. Preserving food without freezing or canning, traditional techniques using salt, oil, sugar, alcohol, vinegar, cold storage, and lactic fermentation. This is written by the gardeners and farmers of Tierra Vivante. And I would also add as a technique for preserving foods is dehydrating our foods. It's a really helpful way to do it and much better than canning. All of these techniques are better than canning. And then there's the book The Forager's Harvest by Samuel Thayer, Thayer. We all need to know how to gather the wild superfoods of our local areas. And then a novel, it's called Anastasia, The Ringing Cedars of Russia by Vladimir Verger, V-E-R-G-E. It's a wonderful deep look at what living in truth means. Tip of the season here. As we gather our food to prepare for winter, remember it's time now to start with some warming herbs like ginger, cinnamon, nutmeg, and curries to collect the warmth of the sun on the body's surface and to bring it more deeply within our inner being and our inner organs, our core, so that we will have a warm, dry interior to carry us with health and stamina through the coming months. As the weather cools down more, drink more of the warming teas and use the warming herbs in your cooking. And I'd like to read a little passage from the book Seasons of the Sacred Earth.
Once upon a time, the world was a wilderness with small settled enclaves scattered about. A village here and there, each surrounded by its pastures and meadows, while vast untamed land lay beyond. But whether in the village or on the last barn in the wood,
the green permeated everything.
The lives of farmers raising their crops, the activities of wives at the hearth, the work of local artisans.
Balanced with the green brought prosperity and happiness to everyone.
So quite without understanding what I was undertaking, I began practicing what is now called primitive technology, learning through experimentation how to apply the life skills of the ancients. The practice of primitive technology reveals the inner world of elder peoples who lived much closer to the land than we do now. Daily life required they possess a deep understanding of the mystic and physical workings of the green world. So it stands to reason that emulating their lifestyles will integrate us with nature. Ultimately, restoring the human relation with the green will even be essential to the survival of everything that we share this world with.
Our species is at a crossroads in history.
It has the technology now to grant itself all sorts of material goods and marvels, but that technology comes at a staggering price. The consumption of vastly unsustainable amounts of natural resources and lifestyles that are exceedingly toxic to the environment. Or our species can choose to walk nature's way. A balanced, gentler path that is good for people and the sacred earth. Humanity has historically been motivated by a spiritual path. Whole civilizations have risen, warred, and fallen over spiritual paths. If it is to go a better way, redeem itself and save this one and only earth,
humankind must change at a level of spirit into something kinder and gentler.
Whatever we can do in our small ways, step by step, adding into the ancient and adding into the new by remembering the old ways, as in primitive technology, living in harmony with the land, we can teach and we can share and we can hope that people would come on board. And we can impart a bit of essential wisdom. And it would be just this.
Spirit and enchantment and reality are bound together in a green world full of wonders.
If you are intrepid enough to peer into it, it will heal you and it will heal the earth.
So the sacred year will spiral on. Nature will follow its timeless rituals, and perhaps you will find your own means to walk its way.
And remember, it's only a dream. It's only a dream. It's only a dream.
Thank you for joining me today for this segment of Living Well with Linda. I'm Linda Wiley. If you would like to chat further with questions, comments, or consultations, please contact me at linda@prestia.com. Thank you and blessings to all. Blessings to all. Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows LIVE for Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, with Heisey Lutmers and Charlie Harrington, Tuesday evening at 8 p.m.